Welcome back to our exploration of cosmology. In this lecture, I'd like to give you an update on a topic or a discovery that was announced just before my 1998 course for the teaching company, and which was, at that time, in 1998, still quite tentative, but enormously exciting. In the 5 years since, it has revolutionized astronomy, cosmology, and in fact, fundamental physics. The conclusion is that the universe is accelerating in its expansion, speeding up with time, rather than slowing down as had been expected. It's a remarkable conclusion. It caught us all by surprise. And I'd like to give you the evidence in this lecture and show you how compelling the evidence now is in this lecture and the next lecture. We've known for a long time now that the universe is expanding. Here again is Hubble's law: the recession speed of galaxies along the vertical axis versus their distance along the horizontal axis. This represents a snapshot of the universe right now. Galaxies that are more distant from us right now are moving away from us faster than galaxies that are nearby. Okay? The Hubble law. V is proportional to D. We say that V is H naught, the Hubble constant right now, times D. Now, as I mentioned a few lectures ago, Hubble's law does not imply that the distance of any particular galaxy is increasing with time. Hubble's law alone does not imply that. Looking at it, you might think that it does, because as the distance of a galaxy increases, it looks like its speed of recession increases because of this Hubble constant being a constant. If D doubles, V should double. But that's not true. Because Hubble's constant, or many astronomers like to call it Hubble's parameter, is a constant at a given time throughout space, throughout the universe, but it changes with time within the universe. So, in fact, if Hubble's constant decreases with time, which it does in all simple models for the expansion of the universe, then the speed of a galaxy, of a given galaxy, does not increase. It remains the same or even decreases with time. If the Hubble constant or Hubble parameter is decreasing with time, then as the distance d of a galaxy increases, the v, the velocity, can still decrease. I emphasize this point because many people don't understand it. They think that Hubble's law automatically implies an accelerating universe, and it does not. It does not, okay? In fact, we all expected the universe to be decelerating in its expansion with time. The reason is that there's galaxies and other forms of matter in the universe, and they all pull on one another. So, for example, the Earth and the apple pull on each other. And when I toss the apple up in the air, the attractive gravitational force between the Earth and the apple decelerates the apple in its upward journey. And in fact, its deceleration is so great that eventually the apple reaches the highest position and then comes crashing back down. All right? So there's so much mass in the Earth and in the apple that their mutual gravitational pull slows the apple down enough to be able to bring it back down to my hand. If our universe had so much material, it too would expand for a while and then come crashing back down. Let me show you the separation between arbitrary galaxies. Best to have them in superclusters that are different, because then you have a lot of empty space between the superclusters and the expansion of the universe is most clearly represented by clusters of galaxies that are far from each other. If galaxies are bound within a cluster, they don't expand. So let this be the separation between galaxies in different clusters versus time. Okay? In a dense universe, you start out with a big bang at this point, zero separation between galaxies. The separation quickly increases, but it increases at an ever-decreasing rate, reaches a maximum separation at some time after the explosion or after the Big Bang, and then the separation between those galaxies decreases, and finally they collapse in on each other in the Big Crunch. Okay, so you have a Big Bang and then a Big Crunch, or a Big Bang and a Gnab-Gib, which is Big Bang backwards. All right. So in a dense universe, it expands for a while, and eventually recollapses. That also happens to be the kind of universe that is finite in volume. It wraps around itself, much like a balloon. So here's a two-dimensional hypothetical universe where the universe is just the surface of the balloon. Outside the balloon and inside the balloon are irrelevant. They're not part of this hypothetical universe. So it's a two-dimensional curved universe. You can go forwards and backwards, left and right, but up and down are forbidden by the laws of physics in this hypothetical universe. This is a closed universe, a finite volume universe, in this case, finite surface area, because it's two-dimensional. This is the kind of universe which could expand for a while and then recollapse in a gnab-gib. All right? Oh. All right. If, however, there's not enough matter to reverse the expansion, suppose I threw this apple really fast and there were no gravity or very little gravity, then it would slow down ever so slightly and continue going away from the Earth forever. That's like a rocket fired at greater than Earth's escape speed. Had I eaten my Wheaties this morning, I could have, in principle, heaved this apple so fast that relative to the gravitational pull, attracting it back to the Earth, its initial energy with which it was thrown was sufficiently large to keep it going away from the Earth forever. So it would escape from the Earth, but it would nevertheless always slow down. It wouldn't speed up because there's always some gravity pulling on it. It's just not enough to bring it back down. So that's exactly like a rocket tossed at greater than the escape speed. So in that case, in a low-density universe, you would have galaxies separating away from each other, and they'd be slowing down with time, but they'd not slow down enough to ever reverse their motion. It would be something like that. And the limiting case of that is an empty universe where there's no gravity whatsoever, and then the galaxies just move away from each other at a constant speed forever. Now, the boundary between a recollapsing universe and one that easily expands forever is the universe that was sort of thrown at the escape speed. It's like an apple thrown at exactly the escape speed from Earth. It slows down forever, but it only comes to a complete stop as time approaches infinity. And that's the critical or medium density universe indicated on this graph. It's a universe that doesn't quite reverse its motion, but it doesn't easily expand forever. It only just barely expands forever. Let's let rho represent density, the lowercase Greek letter rho. And we'll discuss the average density, rho average of the universe, and a certain quantity called the critical density, rho critical, given by some combination of numbers, including the Hubble constant. We can define omega sub matter to be the average density of the universe divided by this critical value. The critical value corresponds to only about 6 hydrogen atoms per cubic meter of space. That's the critical value of the density. Now, if the average density is greater than this critical value, then omega sub matter will be greater than 1. That corresponds to a universe that it will eventually undergo a big crunch, a gnab-gib. All right? So that's the closed universe that's shaped like a balloon, like a three-dimensional balloon. If, on the other hand, the average density is equal to the critical density, then the ratio of the two, being omega sub matter, will equal 1 exactly. That corresponds to the universe that was ejected at the escape speed. It's the universe that expands forever, but only just barely. And if the average density is less than the critical density, then the ratio of the two, omega sub matter, will be less than unity, and that's the universe whose expansion never stops and doesn't even approach zero. It approaches some constant speed as time goes to infinity. The omega equals 1 universe that barely expands forever, whose speed approaches zero, corresponds, according to general relativity, to flat Euclidean space. All right? Omega greater than 1 corresponded to a sphere. Omega equals to 1 corresponds to a flat sheet of paper. and omega less than 1 corresponds to something akin to a horse's saddle. It's called a negatively curved or a hyperbolic universe, as opposed to an uncurved flat universe and a positively curved spherical universe. So those are the three simple kinds of universes that can exist. Well, when we look at the matter in the universe, we can count up the number of galaxies per unit volume and spread it all out across the universe, including all the voids and things like that. And we find that observationally, including the luminous and the dark matter that we know to exist, the average density is only 30% of the critical density. So omega matter is only about 0.3. So we expect our universe to actually be undergoing a curve that looks something like this, the omega matter 0.3 curve. In other words, it should be decelerating, but it should expand forever at an ever-decreasing rate because we measure omega matter to be 0.3. That's what we expect to find. But there's one other theoretical possibility in principle. What if there's a repulsive force in the universe? Albert Einstein considered such a possibility in 1917, shortly after publishing his equations for the general theory of relativity. He reasoned that there are galaxies or stars in the universe. They didn't know about galaxies for sure at that time. They just thought maybe there are other galaxies out there. But in any case, there's all this stuff in the universe, and it isn't obviously falling in on itself. Nothing is falling in. The sky isn't falling. So he reasoned that there might be some kind of a repulsive force pushing things out, keeping them in a static situation. So here you can see the Milky Way galaxy and another galaxy being attracted to it because of the force of gravity. To prevent it from crashing in on the Milky Way galaxy, Einstein invented a repulsive force, lambda, which he called the cosmological constant, which he took to be exactly equal in size, in magnitude, but opposite in direction to the attractive force of gravity. He didn't like this cosmological constant. It was inelegant. It was aesthetically unpleasing. It made the equations not as beautiful. They were mathematically correct, but not as beautiful in his opinion. There was no laboratory evidence for a repulsive sort of force. It was kind of an ad hoc thing that he thought up just to produce a static universe, but he didn't like it. Nevertheless, at that time, people thought the universe was static, and so there was the possibility of a repulsive effect. Suppose that that lambda were bigger than it needs to be to make a static universe. Then you could have a universe that accelerates. It's not in a delicate balance. Instead, anti-gravity, if you will, dominates over gravity and pushes the whole thing apart faster and faster. That is a theoretical possibility. So one other curve that we should add to those that I've drawn earlier is one that kind of looks like this. It's the dashed line that accelerates upwards. The separation between galaxies speeds up with time when the universe is old enough. Originally, the galaxies slow down as they recede from one another, and that's because they're so close to one another that their attractive gravity is strong. When they're close together, they attract each other and they slow each other down. But this anti-gravity effect could kick in later in the universe's history, later in its future, I should say. Kicks in and makes the galaxies zoom apart from one another. That is a theoretical possibility, so we should keep it in mind. Well, all right. You can look at galaxies like those in the Hubble Deep Field at a variety of distances, and from making measurements of the distance and the redshift, the recessional speed, you can figure out which of these theoretical curves the universe has actually been following, and you can predict what it will do in the future. Encrypted in the light of those galaxies is that information from the distance versus recession speed or redshift relationship for galaxies. You can figure this out. So you need good distances for these galaxies, and you need to measure their redshifts. But in principle, you're looking back in time and seeing what the expansion of the universe used to be doing throughout its history, if you have enough measurements. That's the idea. That's how we can figure out what the universe has been doing in the past and predict what it will do in the future. So I'm part of a team, the High Redshift Supernova Search Team, that embarked to do just that, to measure the expansion history of the universe. Our team leader is Brian Schmidt of the Australian National Observatory, and Adam Rees, a postdoctoral fellow who worked with me at Berkeley for a number of years, did a lot of the number crunching. There was another team, the Supernova Cosmology Project, led by Saul Perlmutter of the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, which was doing the same thing. And in fact, I was for a while a member of both teams, but I'm primarily a member of this one whose picture I've showed. That's about half the team members right there. So we went out and we looked for type 1A supernovae, a nearby example of which is shown here, and distant examples of which would reveal the distances of the galaxies in which they're located. Again, it's this inverse square law that I described a few lectures ago. Measure the apparent brightness of a distant supernova, compare it with the apparent brightness of a nearby supernova of known distance, and in that manner determine the distance of the distant one, like determining the distance of an oncoming car at night. So we found and calibrated nearby ones, and we also found distant ones, three of which are shown here, marked with arrows. These are supernovae in very distant galaxies. And by measuring their apparent brightness, we came to the conclusion that basically they're too far away. They're too far away to have gotten there in any reasonable universe, in any reasonably behaving universe. I'll discuss this in more detail throughout the rest of this lecture. But they're too far away to have gotten there, basically, without an acceleration of the universe, without a repulsive effect between the galaxies. And so, in fact, we cautiously, in 1998, announced the possible existence of a cosmic anti-gravity force at work. I use the term anti-gravity somewhat hesitantly, because when I talk with people about this, they ask me invariably, can we use this to levitate over traffic jams, you know? And no, you can't use this to do that or to make anti-gravity boots or whatever. It's not a local effect. It's a very subtle effect that only manifests itself over distances of billions of light years, not here on Earth. All right. Our team leader, Brian Schmidt, said, "My own reaction is somewhere between amazement and horror. Amazement because this is not what we or anyone else expected to find. Horror because at the time that we announced it, we still weren't certain that we have the right answer. You know, there could be errors along the way." Let me discuss in some more detail what it is that we actually see. When I said that the galaxies were farther away than they could have gotten in any respectable universe, what I meant was that when you look at this apple and you toss it, all right, let's say we measure its distance from my hand after 1 second of travel. Suppose the universe is 1 second old, this hypothetical universe. Well, it gets to some distance after 1 second, all right? But it's been decelerating. So that distance isn't as great as it could have been had it been decelerating less. Suppose it were slowing down less. Then in 1 second, it would get to a greater distance. Suppose it weren't slowing down at all. I toss it, and there's no gravity. In 1 second, it gets to some distance, and that's the maximum distance which it can reach in any non-accelerating universe. The no-gravity universe gives you the maximum distance that an apple can reach in a given amount of time. What we found was, basically, by analogy, the apple was farther away than that maximum distance in a non-decelerating universe. Hence, the universe is accelerating. It's as though the apple has a rocket attached to it. And you release it, and it slows down for a while, and then the rocket kicks in and goes zoom like that, and makes it reach a greater distance than it otherwise could have. Well, you might think, this sounds interesting, but isn't there an obvious flaw or a potential flaw in this argument? What if the assumed age of the universe is wrong? What if the universe is actually 2 seconds old, not 1 second old? In 2 seconds, the apple obviously can reach a greater distance than in 1 second. So suppose we just got the age of the universe wrong when making this comparison. Well, good try if you were thinking that. Very clever. But it turns out that the detailed argument that we use is independent of the assumed age of the universe. And I'd like to demonstrate that in the next few minutes. And it's something I wasn't really able to do in my 1998 course, because there was insufficient time. So let's look at these curves again. All the curves sort of generally slope upwards from the beginning up to a time t now. But notice that though they all meet at a common slope here, that's just the current expansion rate of the universe. That's essentially a measure of the Hubble constant. The expansion rate of the universe now is whatever it is, and so all these model universes have to agree, they have to meet at this one point so that the expansion rate right now is whatever it is, all right? So they meet right here, and that means that in a plot of recession speed versus distance, all these models give you the Hubble law at small distances, all right? They all give you the straight line, the slope of those curves at t equals now. But notice the curves diverge at greater distances. You have different recession speeds for a given distance at large distances. How is that? Well, let's go back to this plot. If we look at a given time in the past, so here we are at t naught now, and we look back at a given time in the past, you'll see that going upwards along this graph, the different curves have different slopes. This one, the strongly decelerating curve, has a steep slope. The medium density curve has a less steep slope. The empty universe has a less steep slope still. And this accelerating model has the most shallow slope. So at a given time in the past, the curves have different slopes. Well, a given time in the past is a given look-back time, right? 4 billion years, let's say. Light travels at the speed of light, so 4 billion years corresponds to some distance. So this means that the curves begin to diverge. They have different slopes for a galaxy at a given distance, depending on which model the universe is actually following. The slope was the greatest in the strongly decelerating, the dense universe. It was less in the critical density universe. It was less still in the low density universe. It was less still in the empty universe. And the slope was even smaller in the accelerating universe. So the idea is, go back in time, measure the distances and the recession speeds of galaxies at a variety of distances, plot them on this graph, and see which curve the universe has actually been following. That's the idea, okay? That's the gist of the argument. So that's what we did. We went off and we looked at galaxies. And by the way, I should mention that in that graph I just showed, in 1998, I had the two axes reversed. I had distance along the vertical axis and recession speed along the horizontal axis. That's fine, but this year I decided to have all my Hubble diagrams be consistent and have distance along the horizontal axis and speed along the vertical axis, just for consistency. I think that helps avoid confusion, all right? But if you compare this lecture with what I gave in 1998, you'll notice that the graph looks different, okay? So we looked at a bunch of distant galaxies by taking deep pictures of the sky like this one. And in this picture, you can see literally thousands of galaxies, just a whole bunch of them. Most of the dots in that picture are galaxies, not stars in our own galaxy. And we took several pictures over the course of a month or two. And when you compare the new pictures with the old pictures, in this case, 28th of April 1997 versus 7th of April 1997, and you digitally subtract the two, you find that in the new picture, the one taken on the 28th of April, there's a dot that wasn't there on the 7th of April. And that dot is a candidate supernova. We would announce these candidates in batches of 12 or 18 or 20 at a time. This is not really meant to be a readable table. It just shows you that by taking deep pictures of the sky containing thousands of galaxies, you can find dozens of supernovae on just a couple of nights because there's so many galaxies that surely some stars are exploding in some of them. And we got spectra of these galaxies using the biggest telescopes in the world, the Keck telescopes in Hawaii, with which we could get spectra of these very, very faint galaxies and of the supernovae that they contain. We got spectra of the galaxies to get their redshifts. We got spectra of the supernova candidates to make sure that they are supernovae of the right kind. We're using the type 1A supernovae. And when we get good ones, then, you know, you can see from the plot that they look exactly like a nearby supernova of the 1A variety. This lower plot is a nearby type 1A supernova, 1989B. This is a distant one at redshift 0.455. You can see that the bumps and wiggles reproduce quite accurately. This is a nice type 1A supernova at a large redshift. And that makes me happy. And here you can see the real reason we build observatories in Hawaii. I like the beach just as much as anyone else does, of course. Well, things don't go always so well. Sometimes it snows up there. Yes, Hawaii's in the tropics, but Mauna Kea volcano is nearly 14,000 feet high, and it's cold up there, so it snows. So a couple of years ago, during my longest observing run of the year, it was about a week long, it snowed the first couple of nights, so we couldn't open the dome. And then it didn't snow the next couple of nights, but it was windy, and the wind kicked up the snow, and it deposited, or it would have deposited it, in the open dome, had the dome been open. So the telescope operator wouldn't open the dome for me, even though the sky was clear. And regardless of the size of the green bill that I dangled in front of the telescope operator, he wouldn't open the dome. So that's the way it goes. So I lost a whole week's worth of observations. Things don't always go well up there. You could get all depressed and everything, but, you know, you make the best of a bad situation and you do something else. So, you know, you can ski up there. Well, you can't quite ski from the mountaintop all the way down to the beach and jump in, because these are the tropics and the snow stops about a third of the way down. But, you know, you can ski and then later on you can go swimming at the beach if you want. Well, the supernovae that turned out to be genuine type 1A supernovae at large redshifts were followed both from the ground and with the Hubble Space Telescope. And here you see four images of these supernovae obtained with Hubble. These are the best data. And we measure the brightness of the supernova along the vertical axis versus time along the horizontal axis. They brighten and fade. We can derive the distance from the peak brightness using the inverse square law and plot the distance along the horizontal axis versus the redshift or recession speed along the vertical axis. And we did this for a whole bunch of supernovae in late 1997, early 98. And our data followed this weird curve, this dotted line that represents a cosmological constant, an anti-gravity, an accelerating universe, almost like an amount of matter, omega matter, less than zero. That's kind of like what anti-gravity is. Weird, an accelerating universe, independent of the assumed age of the universe. That's the point. It's independent of the assumed age of the universe. It's almost as though the universe has, on large scales, and a repulsive effect quite reminiscent of Einstein's cosmological constant. And so, in fact, we suggested this might indeed be Einstein's original cosmological constant. You can see newspaper headlines here in the New York Times, "Wary astronomers ponder an accelerating universe." You could just as well have said, "Weary astronomers," not from all the nights we spent obtaining data, but from all the sleepless nights we spent worrying that we had made an error in our measurements or in our calculations and that we were getting the wrong answer. You know, we could lose our funding for a simple error like 2 plus 2 equals 5 in a computer program. Errors like that don't advance science. More subtle errors do, so that would have been okay. But we were worried that we had just made some terrible blunder, you know. My postdoctoral researcher, Adam Rees, who did a lot of the measurements and the number crunching, was featured in a huge story in Time magazine, richly deserved because he did a lot of the work, as did many of us on the team, but he was the one who first saw the result. By the end of the year, there was a cover story in Science magazine which proclaimed this discovery of the accelerating universe and cosmic anti-gravity to be the top scientific breakthrough of the year in all of science. And both of the discovery teams were quite honored by this, but also we were just still unsure that the discovery was correct. But, you know, the editors of Science magazine said that rarely is a discovery of this sort announced and confirmed beyond any shadow of a doubt in the same calendar year. And they seemed pretty certain that we were on the right track because a lot of people had tried to shoot down our result and were unable to do so in any obvious way. The caricature of Einstein here is surprised because he's blowing a bubble out of his pipe and the bubble's expansion is speeding up with time, not slowing down. Now, he's doubly surprised because on this sheaf of papers, he has an equation written down, the equation for his cosmological constant, for this idea that he had dreamed up in 1917 to have a static universe, a repulsive effect that he didn't like, and which he later renounced when Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe. There was no need for a repulsive effect. The universe could have been born in an expanding state and just been expanding right now without any further repulsion. So he had actually renounced the cosmological constant in 1929. Nevertheless, he had dreamed it up in 1917, and here we are resurrecting it. We're resurrecting the idea, not to have a static universe, but rather to have an accelerating universe. In other words, the magnitude, the size of the cosmological constant is larger than what is needed to make a static universe. It wins over gravity at large distances and causes the universe to repel itself at large distances. And this would have been quite surprising to Einstein because he didn't like the cosmological constant. He called his introduction of the cosmological constant the biggest blunder of his career, because had he not insisted on its validity, he would have predicted that the universe must be in some sort of a state of motion rather than being static. And instead, he explained why it's static, and it's not static after all, and he considered that to be the biggest blunder of his career. Well, with time, Einstein's repulsive idea grew some acceptance within the community of astronomers and physicists. They were quite skeptical initially because the data were still a little bit sketchy. The conclusion was not particularly firm. But in the years since 1998, more and more data have substantiated this claim. So Einstein's repulsive idea has caught on, and lots of theoretical physicists are now trying to understand what could be causing this repulsion, as I'll discuss in the next few lectures. The general public seemed incredibly interested by this. I spoke at many places, and there were always many, many people interested in this. So did all the other team members. Everywhere we went, people wanted to know about anti-gravity. In all walks of life, people wanted to know about anti-gravity. In fact, at the Keck Observatory, presidential candidate Al Gore visited my team in order to find out the inside scoop on the accelerating universe. Perhaps he hoped that this would help his chances for election. I guess it didn't, or at least not in Florida. So, what is this stuff all about? Could we be wrong? Could there be some subtle error going on? There clearly wasn't an obvious blunder in the computer programs because a number of people had independently written the analysis programs and achieved the same result. But could there be something subtle wrong? For example, suppose there's dust between us and the supernovae, or fog, or something like that. If you're looking at a distant car through fog, and you don't take proper account of the fog, you will overestimate the distance of the car because its headlight will appear dimmer than it would have had there been no fog present. In fact, you'd better take account of fog when you're driving or you're getting into a crash. So suppose there's fog along the way dimming the supernovae. Well, just as the setting sun looks dimmer when it's setting, so too it looks redder. And that's because the blues and the greens get selectively absorbed and scattered by dust, leaving behind the oranges and the reds. I've discussed that extensively. In a similar manner, interstellar gas and dust selectively dims blue light more than red light. So had there been stuff along the way, we would have expected the supernovae at large distances to look anomalously red, and they do not. They look the normal colors. So we conclude from this that there isn't stuff along the way. Suppose instead that the white dwarfs that were exploding back then were somehow different from the ones that are exploding now. Recall that the white dwarf increases its mass by gaining material from a companion star. Suppose the mass at which it blows up is slightly different long ago than it is now. Maybe because white dwarfs had a different chemical composition back then. There weren't as many heavy elements around back then. That could influence the peak power of a supernova. Well, it should also influence the spectrum of the supernova. So we compared in some detail the spectra of distant supernovae with nearby supernovae. And here you can see in this top plot the spectrum of a high redshift Z equals 0.46 supernova, and below it, a low redshift supernova. And they look very similar. They look kind of noisy. All data have noise, but they look quite similar at peak brightness and also about 2 weeks later when the spectra have changed. Again, there are broad similarities, and in fact, even detailed similarities, suggesting that the explosion occurred the same way back then as it does now. If it had exploded differently, with a very different peak power, we also would have expected some differences in the spectrum, and yet they do not appear. So this gives us some confidence that what we're saying is right, and that the extra dimness of the distant supernovae is due to an extra distance and not to some astrophysical effect leading us to come to the wrong conclusion. Nevertheless, one should be a skeptic when considering results of such far-reaching consequences, and you should check those results in as many ways as possible. A smoking gun for a cosmological constant or some other sort of a repulsive effect, on the one hand, as opposed to some astrophysical effect like extra dimming or the white dwarf exploding in some other way, on the other hand, can be obtained in the following way. If you look back in this diagram, you'll notice, as I said previously, that early on the universe was decelerating. It was slowing down with time as the galaxies were still quite close to each other and their gravity was strong. But as they got far apart from each other and gravity weakened, the repulsive effect kicked in and began to dominate, and it will dominate more and more in the future. So although at relatively nearby big distances of only 3 or 4 billion light years away, the universe was accelerating, far, far away, long in the past, 10 billion years ago, see, time equals now, time equals 10 or 7 or 8 billion years ago, the universe should have been decelerating, and that means that galaxies were receding from us less quickly than would have been expected, and that means that supernovae didn't get as far away as might have been the case had the universe been accelerating always, or as might have been the case had we thought that some sort of extra dimming effect is going on due to dust or something. You know, if something is causing the supernovae at 4 billion light years away to look too dim, then surely the ones at 8 billion light years away would look even dimmer because there's even more dust or even more evolution of the white dwarf or whatever. Okay? So an astrophysical effect would cause the even more distant ones to look even dimmer, whereas a cosmological constant now, an acceleration now, was preceded by deceleration in the distant past. And during that era of deceleration, distances weren't increasing very rapidly, and so a supernova should look somewhat brighter than in the case of dust blocking our view. So we expect very distant supernovae to look somewhat brighter. And in fact, we found one in 1997 that brightened in a galaxy about 11 billion light years away. And you can see the light from that supernova going through 10 or 11 billion light years of space, 10 or 11 billion years of time, through all the empty space, past all the intervening galaxies, coming to us from a region of the sky that's in the Big Dipper. In fact, it's part of the Hubble Deep Field that I've discussed before. So that supernova was found right there in the Hubble Deep Field, and we got measurements of it by taking pictures first of the Hubble Deep Field in 1995 and then again in 1997. Here's the picture from 1995, and then another picture from 1997. They look about the same, but if you take the difference between the two, you see that in 1997, there's in fact an extra dot, and that dot is the supernova candidate, supernova 1997 FF. We measured its brightness. It was brighter than expected in a universe which has dust in the way or in which the white dwarfs are evolving. It was brighter than expected. But it was the right brightness if the universe was decelerating initially and then later accelerated with time. So this was the smoking gun. Distant supernovae look too dim, but in a first decelerating and later accelerating universe, the very distant supernovae look brighter because of the deceleration. So in fact, this is what we think is going on. There was a big bang, and then slowing expansion, and then speeding up or accelerating expansion. An animation that shows this even better is given here. The universe started with a big bang, initially slowed down in its expansion, and then started speeding up. There it goes, speeding up. And the supernova that we found was from an era when the universe was still slowing down. And that's the distinctive signature of a universe which is now dominated by a repulsive effect, but used to not have a repulsive effect. All right? So we think that this conclusion is pretty secure now. We've measured many, many more supernovae in the past 5 years, one of which is shown here, supernova 2002 DD in a galaxy at redshift 0.95. There's another brighter galaxy next to it at 0.79. We now have over 200 supernovae, and we can now see that the amount of cosmological constant is about 0.72 in the units that are similar to the units in which we measured the matter density of the universe, 0.28. Those units are shown right here. We can define omega sub lambda to be lambda c squared over 3 times the Hubble constant squared. Those are units that are analogous to the units in which we measured omega m, where omega m was the average density of the universe divided by the critical density. So in these units, what we find is that the cosmological constant right now is 0.72. The matter density of the universe is 0.28. And this is based on an analysis of over 200 type 1a supernovae. Okay? It's a pretty solid result from the supernovae now. Moreover, as I will describe in the next lecture, there's a completely independent set of measurements from a satellite, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, which gives essentially exactly the same numbers, omega lambda 0.73, omega matter 0.27. These are now independent ways of getting the same thing. And the microwave experiments have nothing to do with the supernovae. So you could say, well, the supernovae are wrong in some way. You know, there's something subtle. Despite all our cross-checks, there's something subtle going on which is fooling us into thinking that the universe is now accelerating and used to be decelerating. But the microwave background results give exactly the same result. That gives us great confidence, or greater confidence, that what we've said is correct. So what is the stuff? Well, it's not luminous matter, because that gravitates, that pulls. It's not dark matter, because that also pulls. It's also not antimatter. You might think antimatter has anti-gravity, but it doesn't. Antimatter has normal, attractive gravity. This is some sort of weird new energy, funny energy, or dark energy, or vacuum energy. The common term now is dark energy, but I don't really like that term, because we all learned on our mother's knee that E equals mc squared. So does dark energy equal dark matter? No, it doesn't. Dark energy is the opposite of dark matter. Dark matter pulls, dark energy pushes. So unless this dark energy turns off, we now think we know how the universe will end. We think it will accelerate forever. It'll certainly expand forever, because there's not enough matter to ever reverse the expansion. But we actually think now it'll accelerate. And that means that if you want to look at clusters of galaxies like this Virgo cluster shown here, you'd better do so in the next 100 billion years or so, because after that, it'll have been whisked beyond our vision, outside the visible horizon of our universe. So our universe will end in cold, icy state, dilute, dark. not hot and dense, not a fiery death like in The Big Crunch. And Robert Frost knew of these two possibilities, the collapse, the dense, hot collapse of the universe, and an icy, eternal expansion. In his poem, Fire and Ice, he wrote, "Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if I had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice." So Frost would prefer there to be a big crunch, but if he had to perish twice, eternal expansion is okay, ending in ice. Perhaps appropriate, given his name, Robert Frost.